Welcome to MoneyWeb Now. Business news every morning.
It's Wednesday, 12 Jan. I'm Simon Brown, coming at you live and loud from the MoneyWeb Global Headquarters in Johannesburg, South Africa. On the show today, Jimmy Moyoha, we touch on the sea harvest, but also Avenge. I got to say, fishing stocks always interest me, but they always disappoint. Maybe I'm just missing something here. Maybe I should just miss the fish stocks. John Luce, property sector strategist at FNB, on property trends we expect to see in 2022. And Mike Brown from ETFSA, growth in the local ETF market in 2021, dominated by three players, Satrix, Signia and Absa, and huge growth in ETNs. This show is brought to you by StanLib. Visit stanlib.com to get in touch with one of their investment specialists. StanLib Asset Management is an authorized financial services provider. Morning headlines from MoneyWeb. Just how broken is Massmart's game? Sales down by shockingly large numbers, but devil in the detail. A great dive into a game obviously owned by Massmart. And Business Day, Tongaat flags delay in its $450 million claim against former directors. Those directors implicated in underhand practices, as civil claims expected to begin only in 2023. And I got to say, $450 million seems like a bit of a small number. Morning markets, lots of green. The US was green, S&P up 0.9, NASDAQ up 1.5%. We've got Sydney up 0.7%, and Tokyo storming ahead, up 1.9%. Gold, 1,819. Brent, almost $3 higher at 83.76. Rhodium holding at 17,500. Rand, 15.51. Top 40 opening call, looking for a green open, up 960 points. That's about 1.4%. That'll take us to an all-time high at the opening. That is 10 cent trades up 3.2%.
MoneyWeb Now, on the money. Also available on podcast.
Chatting now with Jimmy Moyoha. Jimmy, appreciate the time this morning. I mentioned in the intro there an announcement from Sea Harvest expanding further into Australia. They've already got some Australian assets. They're spending about another 800 million rands in a vertically integrated business there. I always like the idea of fishing stocks, and I've been watching Premier, Sea Harvest, Oceana, all three of them. Truthfully, I haven't put any money in, and good thing, because they've always just been disappointments as an investment.
Morning, Simon. You know what, the fishing stocks in the past, you're very right, we haven't seen the best performance out of them, but I do like what Sea Harvest is doing. I think the angle here in acquiring MGK List, I mean, it's a 60-year-old business in Australia, yeah, and they specialize in international seafood things. The acquisition involves vessels, it involves licensing, fishing rights, and that sort of thing, and they're focused mainly in the Australian region. They do a lot of prawn business, and I think that's one of the primary things that they're marketing there. But if you remember last year, a lot of the companies that were in good structural positions from a balance sheet perspective and all of that were doing strategic acquisitions. Mr. Price did Yuppie Chef, and we went through a lot of those, yeah, a list of those last year, right? But now the other good play here that I'm seeing is the fact that last year we also noted that supply chain constraints were hampering the availability and deliverability of certain businesses. So now this sort of acquisition for me speaks more to wanting to prevent that in future, wanting to secure your supply chains and wanting to ensure that you've got adequate supply for your market and avoid shortages. So I think strategically this could actually turn out to be a very good acquisition. You're diversifying your product, but you're preventing the fact that you will have those supply chain constraints if we should happen to go into lockdowns and those sorts of things again. Because if you've got the vessels and you've got the licenses and you've got everything, you've got the ability to move your product from one country to another country, you're able to then circumvent supply chain restrictions where you may rely on other companies. So I think this could be a good thing for Sea Harvest.
Yeah, I take
only time will tell.
Yeah, and they've got the other Australian business they bought is doing well, and I think we're going to see a lot more of, as you say, that securing of the supply chains. Just, you know, COVID taught us a bunch there. Another small announcement that popped out, Avenge, JP Morgan and Chase now got almost 22.5% of the total issued shares. There's some T's and C's in terms of the direct ownership and the like. Certainly some American American clients really liking this. Is this a stock that interests you? I know, I mean, it was a penny stock, did the consolidation. A lot of the listeners have been all over it as a potential stock for a bit of a construction boom, sort of post the pandemic.
You know what? On the Avenge part, I think this could be a really, really good stock. And I say that largely on the back of two reasons. So the companies that are increasing their shareholdings at this point, JP Morgan and Whitebox, they're in the banking space. We're going through a rights issue. There's a lot happening around the share price and the potential share price and what the valuations could be after the rights issue and that sort of thing. But if you look at the effective result, in a nutshell, what's going to happen is, regardless of whether the rights offer is taken up or not, your two companies are now going to have they're going to find themselves in a situation where they have control over the company, whether directly or indirectly. There's about 6.7 6.7% of shares that are sitting in escrow at the moment, pending all of the rights offers and everything and the restructuring happening. This restructuring has been going on for a couple of years now. It's a very big thing. They've gotten the debt down of the business, and the business is looking very attractive at the moment. So regardless of what happens with this rights offer, it looks as though between Whitebox and JP Morgan, they're going to either hold around 44% and say 53% of effective control of the company. And if you look at two of the core underlying businesses within the group, within the Avenge Group, you've got NRW Holdings in Australia, and that's got McConnell Dowell as a subsidiary company. The valuation there and the cash, the free cash flow on hand for that company alone, its cash flow ratios at the moment are looking exceptionally well. You've also got another company in South Africa, Moolman's Work, who's also got work in hand of about 4.9 billion rand. So between those two companies or two subsidiaries alone, you've basically covered, on the one side, you've covered about 90% of budgeted revenue, and on the other side, you've covered about 81% of budgeted revenues. So aside from everything else, if you strip down and you look at those two companies, what those two companies have as free cash flow and cash flow in hand and the work, the orders that they've got there versus what the JP Morgan and Whitebox are going to be paying for this overall, this is an extreme discount.
Take your brain, and it's still, I mean, it's a micro cap, well, it's a mini stock, it's $3.5 billion, but there's some big numbers there. We will leave that there. Independent analyst Jimmy Moyaha, really appreciate the early morning this morning.
We all have different investment needs. Some of us want to preserve our money for retirement, and others to create wealth for the next generation. At Stanlib, we have a team of investment specialists that can help you achieve any investment goal. So whether your money is looking for more certainty, more return, or more impact through your investments, we have a solution for your investment needs, no matter the time horizon. Join us over the next few months as we provide insights into the solutions we offer to meet your money needs. To find out more, visit stanlib.com or speak to your financial advisor. Stanlib Asset Management is an authorized financial services provider. License number 719.
MoneyWeb now on the money.
Chatting now with John Lucy, he's a property sector strategist at FNB Commercial. John, appreciate the early morning time. Every report you put out just earlier this week, looking at sort of trends in the property market. A couple to touch on. The first is that you're actually, frankly, expecting that sort of the all property vacancy rate actually going to continue rising in 2022.
Yes, Simon, it has been rising for a few years actually before the lockdown period. And my reasoning is a very simple one. I look at GDP projections now. You know, that real GDP, gross domestic product, the measure of national output, that's key to driving overall commercial property demand, I would say. You know, it's a rough indicator. And if one looks at where we are now, last year we believe when the numbers come out that GDP wouldn't have been back at 2019 levels yet after the big dip of 2020. We only expect it to get back to 2019 levels, not growth levels, this year. Now, if you look back to 2019, that was totally insufficient. The sort of growth we were getting and the level of national output that we were getting, it was totally insufficient to stop the rising trend in the all property vacancy rate. So I would say that back at 2019 levels, we're not going to stop it yet. And that all property vacancy, average vacancy rate of MSCI, which in the first half of last year was at about 9.6%, will probably go into double digit territory during the course of this year. That's what I would expect. And that in turn would keep general rentals under for the industry as a whole, and of course, hospital values too.
Yeah, and I take that point. I mean, the property sector was having a tough time ahead of the pandemic. One of the drivers of that is that we are going to see more people going back into the office in 2022. But again, we're not getting anywhere near those 2019 levels. I mean, there's a report that I get every week, and I mean, you know, the major cities in the U.S. are, you know, sort of floating around 30%. Office is going to be the really, really tough space again this year, potentially.
Yeah, so there's a couple of things with regards to that. I mean, firstly, if you just take away the office, the work from home surge, normal old-fashioned economic fundamentals for office are weak.
Yeah.
You had between 7% and 8% drop during the course of late 2020 and some stage last year in employment in the finance, real estate, and business services sector. So just an employment drop alone normally dampens the demand for new for more office space, because it's about employment numbers, especially in that sector. So that's already weak. Then let's go to this big structural change for the office. Yes, the work from home surge. Now more people, I think, will go back to the office as activity normalizes, as we get this, as vaccine rollout continues. That's my assumption. But yes, we're not going back to the levels. We've successfully Zoomified a lot of interaction. We've changed the way we operate. This whole work from home experiment was highly successful. So we don't go back to the levels of office work from that we were at 2019. Many people working maybe 1 or 2 days a week instead of they used to work 4 or 5 days a week. And then what's happened now is that I think a lot of corporate bosses have sat for a year or two and looked at that empty space costing a lot of money. And with all this new, what we call hoteling sort of software and systems that you can put in, you don't have to reserve like we used to do at First Rand. Every single person had their own desk, reserved for them. And whether they were on leave, sick leave, or traveling or out visiting clients, it didn't matter. They had this empty desk sitting there reserved for them. That's inefficient. That's wasteful. Now we're moving to systems called hoteling, where if you don't book a desk for tomorrow, you don't have a desk. So that enables more efficient use of space. And I think that, too, in the next few years, will cut down on the office space requirements of many companies.
A quick last one. Industrial sort of logistic has been a winner in the pandemic, particularly as we all started shopping, buying everything online. And that trend is likely to continue in the year.
Yeah, I mean, industrial, especially warehouse space, is the most adaptable property class. It's also the most affordable property class. So that, you know, affordability and adaptability is probably very useful in tough economic times. Its demand doesn't tank as much as expensive retail and office, for instance. So it's held up better. I wouldn't say it's done wonderfully. It hasn't shot the lights out. It's just been the relative outperformer. And yes, of course, that new logistical, so those new logistics requirements for greater online shopping, I think that's going to benefit industrial property or a portion of industrial property, relatively speaking, during the course of this year, and keep it the relative outperformer of all the commercial property sectors.
We'll leave there. John Luce, property sector strategist, F&B Commercial. Appreciate the early morning time.
We all have different investment needs. Some of us want to preserve our money for retirement, and others to create wealth for the next generation. At Stanlib, we have a team of investment specialists that can help you achieve any investment goal. So whether your money is looking for more certainty, more return, or more impact through your investments, we have a solution for your investment needs, no matter the time horizon. Join us over the next few months as we provide insights into the solutions we offer to meet your money needs. To find out more, visit stanlib.com or speak to your financial advisor. Stanlib Asset Management is an authorized financial services provider. License number 719.
MoneyWeb now on the money.
Chatting now with Mike Brown, Managing Director at ETFSA. Mike, appreciate the early morning time. You put out a report yesterday at the exchange-traded product industry for 2021. Assets under management up 22.5%, now topping $136 billion. Perhaps the big standout really for me was 2 points. The first is massive growth in exchange-traded notes, which are slightly different to ETFs. But we've seen F&B issuing a lot, but we've gone from 29 2 years ago to 82 at the end of 2021.
Yes, good morning, Simon. Last year was a good year for the ETP, the exchange-traded product industry. As you say, there was a growth of nearly 25 billion rand in the market cap of the industry, or increase of 22%. And the number of ETFs in issue went from 137 in 2020 to 168 at the end of 2021. Now, there's only about 300 companies listed in the JSE, yeah. And of which there's now 168 ETFs and ETNs. One of the issues you do point out, though, is that there was a big increase in the number of exchange-traded notes issued on the JSE during the course of last year. Now, an exchange-traded note is a listed security just like an exchange-traded fund, but the difference is with an exchange-traded fund, the issuer of the security has to hold the underlying portfolio of shares. So if you're issuing an ETF on the top 40, you have to own all the top 40 shares in exactly the constituent weightings that they make up the index. And so your portfolio that you hold exactly replicates the index, and therefore the price of the ETF trades at the price of the index. When exchange-traded notes, you're not compelled to hold the full portfolio. So you can duplicate or replicate an index using quantitative techniques or whatever have you. You may say, well, I can duplicate the top 40 index by only owning 20 shares rather than all 40 shares because, you know, I can do some fancy footwork on mathematics and my 20-share portfolio effectively replicates the index. But then whoever issues that ETN has to guarantee that they will give you the performance of the index. Not only the index, but the income from that index. So they give you the total return. So the big difference with an ETN is that whoever issues that ETN has to guarantee the return of that ETN, that it gives you exactly the return of the index. And therefore, you have to take the creditworthiness of the issuer of the ETN into account.
And in the case of South Africa, I mean, we've got a couple of big banks. We've got the Union Bank of Switzerland, UBS. So, I mean, it's not a zero risk, but I would call it a very small risk. The other point that really struck home in the report you set out, you list the sort of the different managers and their holdings. Three of them, Satrix, Signia, and Absa, collectively have 75% of the market, which is a big slice, but also highly competitive. They are respectively 27.5%, 25.5%, and 22.5%. We've actually got a very competitive ETP space, which is great for investors.
Yes, it is. It's over 100 billion of the 137 billion is issued by just three companies, as you say, Absa Capital, Signia, Itrix, and Satrix. And it's very competitive between those top three. The other eight issuers of ETFs and ETNs are much smaller. So we've got an industry dominated by three issuers, by three players, and that's not a bad thing because you can have quite a lot of competition between three big companies, and that's what's happening. So during the course of 2021, up until the end of 2020, Absa had always been the biggest issuer of ETFs in South Africa, mainly because of their issues of new gold, new platinum and new palladium, the commodity ETFs. During the course of 2021, both Satrix and Signia overtook Absa, and their focus is on foreign referenced ETFs. So if you want to buy an S&P, an American ETF, if you want to buy a world ETF, if you want to buy an ETF listing Chinese companies, that's where Satrix and Signia come in. And it's great that they've managed to overtake Absa, and they've got a much broader band and range of ETFs to offer to the public.
Overall, a strong industry, a great-looking industry. We'll leave it there. Mike Brown, Managing Director, ETFSA. Appreciate your early morning time. That's it for today. Chatting with Jimmy there earlier, that's our poll we're putting on our LinkedIn and Twitter around Avenge, JP Morgan, Chase, and some T's and C's holding over 22.5%. A lot of activity there. We're asking if you're holding this construction stock that was really on the verge of bankruptcy and a proper penny stock. Have your vote, have your say on LinkedIn and Twitter. Yesterday we were asking about exchange controls. We'd been chatting with Bianca Botas from Citadel Global. We asked if you're using the limit. Almost half of you say pretty much as I can afford, I'm taking offshore. About a quarter saying not really. And then a third saying, yeah, not really enough money to move any offshore. Have your vote, have your say, Twitter and LinkedIn. The show is brought to you by Stanlib. Visit stanlib.com to get in touch with one of their investment specialists. Stanlib Asset Management is an authorized financial services provider. We're live every weekday morning, the MoneyWeb website and the app, 6:30 a.m. Podcast available just after 7. Thanks to my team, Eddie, Nobuchle, Nicole, to you for listening, my guests for their early morning contribution. My name is Simon Brown. This is MoneyWeb Now. We'll chat again tomorrow.
You've been listening to another MoneyWeb Now podcast, posted every weekday at 7 a.m. on moneyweb.co.za. MoneyWeb Now, on the money.